Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Bucks podcast, joining you on a Wednesday, rainy Wednesday, but things are a little bit brighter than they were for Bucks fans a couple days ago. Milwaukee evens its Eastern Conference semifinal series with the Boston Celtics 1-1 after a dominant 21-point win at Pfizer Forum. On Tuesday night, things were a little dicey for a while there for Bucks fans, but maybe a little bit calmer now. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Journal Sentinel Bucks podcast, and on the other line is your favorite, Matt Velasquez, Milwaukee Bucks beat writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Matt, you've endured a couple games so far. It was looking a little, I mean, the national audience was saying the Bucks are in big-time trouble, and then they flip a switch. So even the first half of this second game was a little dicey, and then something happened. They go on this 24-2 run. What happened, Matt? What happened in the second half of game two?
I think there was a lot of focus on the Bucks' need or disinterest or whatever you want to call it in making adjustments. You know, they said at practice on Monday that, you know, they weren't going to make big changes. That they were going to be themselves or do more of what they needed to do, and they were going to turn the series around after a huge loss, 22-point loss in game one. And, you know, while they technically did make some changes, and whether you want to call them major changes or not is maybe a matter of opinion. You know, those changes really helped set the stage for what became a 39-18 third quarter. I mean, the Bucks throughout the game were switching on defense, particularly 1 through 4, often leaving, you know, Brooke Lopez or whoever was playing center to kind of roam and play center field like they normally do. But switching 1 through 4 allowed them to, you know, be up on the Celtics more in their screen game, cut down on pick and pops, cut down on open shots allowed, and really just make the Celtics take, you know, much tougher shots. And in the first half, you know, the Celtics were still making shots at a decent rate. The Bucks were up 4 thanks to a lot of threes by Chris Mullin. I think he had 5 three-pointers in the first half out of going 7 of 10 in the game. But then the third quarter, you know, Bud kind of said, "Hey, well, I think we kind of just wore him down." If you can kind of, you know, put it that way, the Celtics finished the quarter over the last 7 minutes. They were just 1 of 12 from the field, 6 turnovers. Bucks defense was, you know, forcing a lot of tough shots. Got lucky on a couple, you know, like a layup that just bounces off the rim, or a shot rolls out. But still, the defensive pressure that was consistently brought from the Bucks, you know, made things difficult for the Celtics. And with those stops, the Bucks were able to get out, instead of taking the ball out of the hoop, they're able to start, you know, pushing in transition, where Giannis in particular was really good. And usually you associate Giannis being good in transition with him, you know, breaking through for a dunk or a layup or whatever. But he was really a lot more patient on Tuesday night. He didn't just try and, you know, barrel through the Celtics line, the wall that they were trying to form every time that he was on the run. If he had a step or a seam that he would try and go through, often got fouled. But if not, you know, he was getting guys running with him, and as he drew all the attention of the Celtics, he would then kick out, and, you know, maybe he got the assist, maybe he got the hockey assist, but he could find an open guy, or that guy could find someone even more open. Often it was Chris Middleton in the corner, where, again, he cleaned up. If Middleton wasn't in the corner, he was, you know, knocking down pull-up threes on plenty of occasions, and, you know, by being more patient, by finding the right pass and the open guy in those transition situations, the Bucks really looked like a much better offense, a much better team, much more like the team they've been all year in the way they've moved the ball and rained down threes. So, you know, a lot of things that looked like them throughout the year, but, you know, also a few things that they did a little bit differently to bounce back from that 22-point game one loss.
Certainly in that game one loss, the Bucks shot as poorly as they had all year. They'd only had one game in the regular season that had a worse that ended with a worse shooting percentage. But I'm also, one thing that also sticks out to me, as you've described what the Bucks have sort of did differently in game two, or how they look different in game two, but Kyrie Irving was also very different in game two, and maybe that's a function of how the Bucks were able to defend him, but I'm not sure it is. I mean, Kyrie Irving, I thought, was defended pretty well in game one, and he cooked the Bucks pretty well. Game two, he goes 4 of 18, finishes with a negative 19 plus minus. He just wasn't, 9 points. That's just not something that's going to happen again. As you look at this game, not to start in a negative place here, but as you look at this game, do you think that the Bucks can limit Kyrie Irving like that again? And if they can't, are they going to be able to get on runs like that?
I don't think they'll be able to limit Kyrie like that. I mean, 4 of 18 nights just aren't going to happen very often. He's too good of a player, too good of a shot maker, too good of a tough shot maker. He made a bunch of tough shots in game one. He didn't make those tough shots in game two. Just never really got into a rhythm, especially playing in front of his home crowd for games three and four. I think Kyrie will get off a little bit more. The Celtics could probably do some more actions to get him maybe a little bit more open. But even if he's not open, like, he's gonna make shots. He had a couple buckets there early in the third quarter to help the Celtics get within three. Before the Bucks went on that, basically avalanche of a run that ended the game. So Kyrie is, like I said, he's too good. He's gonna get his at some points this series. But if the Bucks can consistently do what they did on Tuesday night, and be aggressive, be, up and contesting everything on defense, whether it's him or the rest of the Celtics, if they can just bring the level of attention to detail and focus that they did with their switching and with their communication, with the calls they were making, the reads they were making, if they can continue to do that, they're generally going to, have better success than not. But, all you can do as a defense in the NBA, if you're not going to get a turnover, that other team's taking a shot, all you can do is, force them into the toughest shot you can and hope they miss. Because, at some point, guys like Kyrie Irving, like Marcus Morris, like Jason Tatum, the list goes on and on with the Celtics. Those guys are going to make tough shots. At some point, you just have to live with it.
Yeah, I thought that was really telling in that third quarter run. The Bucks were forcing those tough shots, and none of them were falling for the Celtics. I mean, they had a lot of shots that just rimmed off in that run. So, not to discount what the Bucks were doing, there was a little element of good fortune. But I think anytime there's a 24-2 run, you got to count on a little bit of good fortune. Another guy we talked a lot about coming into the series is Al Horford, and the Bucks did mitigate him a little bit in the second game. He still finished 6 of 10 shooting. First game, he absolutely tore the Bucks up, 8 of 16. He had 11 rebounds. He finished with 20 points. His defense on Giannis was definitely one of the things people pointed to as a reason why the Celtics were able to really blow out the Bucks in game one. How did you see them treating Horford? I mean, my untrained eye didn't see really a whole lot different between game one and game two, other than just better overall play and fewer shots for Al Horford. But do you think that they addressed him at all, or is this just a situation where he's going to get open looks from time to time and the Bucks simply have to weather that the way the defense is structured?
With the switching that they do, a lot of that was because of Al Horford. They don't switch a lot. They've spent the year dropping on pick and rolls. They haven't had to deal with, pick and pop bigs all that much. But that's going to be a big part of this series. We saw that in game one where Al Horford picking and popping and getting open looks and getting the opportunity to create, with space was a big issue. And so by switching one through four, the Celtics do a lot of small to small screens. Maybe you count Horford as small, maybe you don't. But they don't defend him necessarily with Brook Lopez all the time. And even if they do, they're trying to switch and help and make sure that Horford isn't just catching wide open passes, where he can just kill you in the mid-range, kill you from three-point range. He still was 3 for 5 on threes, and he still, got a few open looks. But it wasn't as consistent as it was in game one. They were making sure to bring that help, make that switch, make that read as quickly as they could and communicate and know where they needed to be so that, if there was a pick and roll or pick and pop situation, Horford wasn't going to see a ton of daylight. And so I think that was a positive for the Bucks in terms of dealing with Horford. Obviously, Horford spends a lot of time on Giannis Antetokounmpo, and he really mitigated him in game one. I thought Giannis did a better job of you know, being physical and getting foul calls while also being patient. He didn't force as many things. In game one, he was really pressing at times, you know, trying to get to the rim and kind of putting up some like layups and making some moves that just didn't look like, you know, the way that he normally would attack the rim. Some of his Euro steps were a little slow, a little shaky. But going against Horford on Tuesday night, I thought that he just made smarter reads. He knew that help was coming and that he'd be able to kick out to teammates and make that extra pass. And then when he went, you know, he was more assertive, more confident in the way that he attacked the rim and was able to get foul calls, able to get, you know, a few dunks and, you know, definitely, you know, better finishes and better looks throughout the game.
You look at the Bucks' starting lineup. They did make a switch late before game two. Originally, Sterling Brown was lined up, as he has typically been in the starting lineup, with Malcolm Brogdon out, and the Bucks changed that up late, went with Nikola Mirotic. Mirotic is still not really really finding that rhythm offensively. He finished 3-10 in game two, but it did hit a couple big shots, in game one. I believe he started 3-3 from three-point range. But I found that interesting, and I'm curious what you think of that. Sterling Brown did get into the game in game two and really struggled. Three quick fouls, finished with a plus-minus of negative 12, no points, and just a little over almost 13 minutes. What did you make of that roster maneuver, and what do you see Mirotić bringing to the table at the moment?
It was interesting because you know, the Bucks, after Brogdon got hurt, they went to Mirotić in the starting lineup. That was kind of the move that the Budenholzer made in the regular season. And a couple of games later, Mirotić broke his thumb on Mo Wagner's face. So they had to adjust. They had to change that up. You know, Tony Snell takes over. He gets hurt. And then Sterling Brown gets into the starting lineup. And he just sticks. Part of that is because Mirotić and Snell were out for so long. And part of that was because he played well toward the end of the regular season. But... you know, with him experiencing some back spasms and some soreness, Bud thought that, you know, at least this was his explanation after the game, was that, you know, hey, Sterling's banged up and Mirotić can shoot and he can stretch the court and we want to try and, you know, do something, you know, different and do something like that, you know, and you know, he thought that Mirotić offered the best, you know, opportunity for them to, you know, to space the floor and do what they wanted to do on defense, especially with Sterling Brown hurting. The problem for the Bucks was that Mirotić, you know, picked up two fouls in 3 minutes and 17 seconds, both shooting fouls, both kind of, you know, plays where he might have been a little over-aggressive going against Jaylen Brown. So he didn't get to really make that much of an impact early, but we saw a lot of Mirotić during that third quarter run. And it wasn't really all at the defensive or the offensive end. It was his defense where he was able to, you know, hang with guys, move his feet well, contest shots, you know, get a body on guys in terms of blocking out. He got 9 rebounds. Just a lot of things on the defensive end where you don't normally associate Nikola Mirotić with, you know, a high level of play. I think, you know, Mirotić, the first, second, and third line, when you're talking about him, are his, you know, are his shooting, his offense, his scoring, his ability to create, just all those types of things. You don't really think about him as a defensive player. I know a lot of people, you know, when they saw the change in starting lineup, you know, they thought, okay, so the Bucks are sacrificing defense for more offense. And I actually brought that up to Nikola Mirotić after the game, and he kind of laughed. He goes, "Oh, what do you think? What do you think? Who said that?" Like, so he, you know, he kind of, you know, was pretty playful about it. You know, but he also said that he takes a lot of pride in the defense, and you know, he knows the offense is going to come. He spent a lot of time watching film and getting ready for the defensive assignments and wanted to prove that he can defend smaller guys and he can keep up with them and he can be an asset on that end. And I'll be, you know, by the time you're reading this, there's probably, or listening to this, you can probably read a story that I'm going to be writing, you know, soon after we record, about Nikola Mirotić and his defense and what he was able to do. Just in talking to him, you know, it seemed like it was really important for him to demonstrate, you know, his ability to help on that end. He ended up finishing with a team-high 3 steals. I think it'll be interesting to see what the Bucks do in Game 3 with their starting lineup and with Mirotić in particular. I'm not sure at this point, if Malcolm Brogdon will be available for Game 3, it's possible that he'll be able to return from his plantar fascia tear by Game 3. You know, he's been progressing. You know, Budenholzer said on Monday that he's starting to look more like the Malcolm that they know. And so, you know, with all the scrimmage time that he's had, the practice time he's had, maybe he'll be back. And so maybe that would put him back into the starting lineup if he's able to play. But I expect that, you know, regardless of Brogdon's availability, you know, we'll be seeing a decent amount of Nikola Mirotic and potentially still in the starting lineup.
Yeah, let's review a little more about Brogdon, what you would expect to see from him if he's able to get into a game. I really thought we would see Brogdon just sparing minutes in one of these first two games. And with him in street clothes, I have to wonder if he's going to play at all in this series, and I'm sure he'll probably suit up at some point, but if he'll play meaningful minutes in this series, because it would seem to me that they're not going to throw him into the fire, have him start, have him play 20 minutes. It's going to be pretty limited. Is that an incorrect assumption, or do you think that they really are letting him get fully 100% healthy so that when he comes back, he is all the way back?
Yeah, I think that he will, if he's cleared, I think that he would probably start. I could see him, you know, getting shorter stints, maybe play. Usually he's one of the first guys out of the game. The Bucks like to, you know, bring in either Ersan Ilyasova, Nikola Mirotic, you know, pack out somebody off the bench for him at about the 7 minute mark of the first quarter. He's usually that first sub. So if he comes back, I think he can continue to do that play, you know, 4 or 5 minutes to start the game. You know, get a rest, maybe come back in late in the first quarter, you know, maybe run a bench unit, mostly bench unit, or, you know, run alongside Giannis Antetokounmpo, who usually comes out for a couple minutes towards the end of the first quarter, and then back in late in the first quarter. So they can kind of dole out the minutes slowly, see how he's feeling, see how he's looking. They'll be able to assess his level of fitness and conditioning to some extent, you know, at the practice facility. The medical team, they have plenty of tools at their disposal to figure out where he stands in terms of his endurance, you know, his load and all those types of things that they measure. But so I think that if he plays, they're not going to put him out there just for a few minutes. I think he'll be able to play, you know, upwards of 20. This is just my guess. This is my gut feel. I don't know at this point exactly how it'll look, but I would think that he'd be, if he's cleared, they'd be able to clear him for, you know, maybe 18 to 22 minutes and maybe more, depending on how he feels or how the game goes. But I don't think they would clear him just to play like 10 to 15 or just, you know, play some small number off the bench. I think if he's back, he's going to be, you know, most, if not all the way back. And how much he plays could depend on just how he feels and how he's able to shake off the rust after, you know, more than 6 weeks out.
What are your thoughts on Brook Lopez? Because we talked before the series about how the Celtics would maybe try to play him off the floor, is kind of the way it's put, because his defense wouldn't be compatible with what the Celtics are able to do. I'm not sure if how we evaluate his defense so far. It does seem like the Celtics have been able to make some headway with him on the floor. Offensively, Lopez has struggled a little bit. He's only scored 13 points over the two games. Just a matter of shots not falling. He's certainly still taking them and looks confident, but the shots haven't been going in. Is there a chance that we see fewer Brook Lopez minutes through the remainder of the Celtics series?
I don't know. I think he'll probably stay around the 25-minute mark. That's what he's been averaging these first two games. You know, game one, he was 1 of 5 and 1 of 4 on threes, and actually +2 in like a generally quiet game from him. And then game two, he plays a little bit less, makes 3 3-pointers, 3 of 10 from the floor, 3 of 8 on threes, and he's -12. Like, he was with the switching that they were doing, you know, they got down by, you know, I think it was 7 in the first quarter, and he was out there for a decent amount of that. He wasn't on the court for a lot of their comeback, or their, not really comeback, I guess comeback in the second quarter, and then their big run in the third. So he wasn't figuring into a ton of their positive stuff in game two, but I can still see how he could be valuable, especially if he's making shots. The way they were switching, the way that they were kind of still holding him back towards the rim a decent amount. He's a deterrent to going into the paint. which it may not show up necessarily as being something that he did or he was involved in, but you know, keeping players from coming into the paint and having them take contested 2-point shots because they don't drive. I mean, there is value in that. We'll see how the Celtics adjust and try and maybe attack him or you know, put him maybe in more pick and rolls or what they can do to take advantage of whatever minutes he's on the court. Obviously, they did, you know, some of that in game two. But Bud's going to go with him. He's not going to take him out of the starting lineup. He's not going to, you know, totally limit his minutes unless there's some type of really dire need for that. I think playing around 25 minutes a game seems like something that would be sustainable, especially if he's making shots.
It seems like with Giannis, you talked about how his game changed a little bit from 1 to 2. We just haven't seen that touch around the rim that he's used to having, and that was especially true to me in game 1 and in the first half of game 2 before he did start to find it working for him a little bit. Obviously, he got to the free throw line a ton, which is a credit to sort of him turning up the notch a little bit on the aggressiveness. That touch, though, is that when you see that, what does that make you think? Is he rushing a little bit? Is he just frazzled because the Celtics can defend? I mean, what would you attribute that to?
I think they've been really physical with him. It's something that most teams do. Because he's not going to get every call. I mean, he will get calls, but he's not going to get every call. And so they're trying to be physical with him. They're trying to show him bodies and make it harder for him to be comfortable as he goes up. There were a few plays in the first half where he went up with these like weird one-handed kind of like kind of push shots. It was just kind of strange. Layups to describe it. I was sitting next to Eric Name from The Athletic during the game, and he kind of described it as like a one-handed like Nerf shot, like when you're playing like a little Nerf hoop, like the kind of stuff you would do because you can't like really shoot it like you normally would. But it was just awkward and weird and different, and I think so that was maybe him trying to hang in the air a little bit longer than he normally does and adjust to the contact, to the contests that the Celtics had. They didn't work. You know, but he definitely looked different in the way that he was bringing those shots and trying to attack the rim. He looked a lot better overall in game two, getting sprung off a lot of screens and, you know, finding his way to the basket in a much better fashion than he did in game one. I think that as long as he, you know, attacks, you know, with assertiveness and he is, you know, confident in what he's doing and isn't, you know, trying to you know, charge through guys or use his elbows or forearms to create space. I think if he just goes up in a fluid motion and is able to, you know, get near the basket, I think more often than not, it's going to fall. It's just a function of, you know, getting the right footwork in, getting, you know, that Euro step down, getting that spin move, you know, tight and putting himself exactly where he needs to be. Because in game one, a lot of his footwork, it seemed like he was just off and kind of, you know, wonky as you went to the hoop, and that's going to affect your touch and your finishing ability. So, you know, being confident, having good footwork, and getting to the rim in the kind of the spots that he has all season, the way that he likes, I think that could be you know, something that would help him going forward.
You know, we talked about the series last year and how it doesn't really compare the Bucks-Celtics playing in the first round last year. I mean, George Hill saw the Celtics later in last year's postseason, a little bit further into things in the Eastern Conference Finals. George Hill must know things that other people just don't know, because on paper, you just wouldn't expect the diminutive veteran guard off the bench to be as effective as he is, and yet George Hill was absolutely their rock in Game 1 when they were still involved, and he had another effective game in Game 2, finishes with 10 points, 3-6 shooting, plus 27. How does George Hill work?
Well, he's a savvy veteran. He knows kind of what is being asked of him. He's got the, you know, the good body for that. He's got long arms, you know, and he's patient. He's got good feet. And so on defense, you know, he's seen Kyrie Irving before in the playoffs. He's seen, you know, the highest levels of the sport. You know, he was in the finals last season, you know, and he was playing a pretty decent role. you know, for that Cavaliers team. And so defensively, he's not jumping and biting at everything. He's not, you know, kind of losing his guy. He's obviously offers, you know, a different look, maybe a change of pace from Eric Bledsoe when defending Kyrie Irving, just because, you know, of how long he is and how, you know, well he stays in front. And he's not necessarily overly aggressive. He's kind of just there and, you know, saying, hey, like, if you want to get by me, like, let's do this. Like, that's kind of, you know, his approach, for lack of a better way of putting it. But then on offense, like, he's not really, you know, forcing anything. You know, he didn't have any turnovers in game two. I have to go back to look at game one, but it's possible he didn't have any turnovers in game one either. I mean, I can't remember any out of hand. But, you know, the important thing is that he takes care of the ball. He knows kind of what his role is. You know, he sometimes, you know, Bud would get on him for, no turnovers in game one either. So sometimes Bud would get on him for not being aggressive enough, for not looking for his shot enough, for not, you know, kind of taking advantage of maybe a mismatch or an open lane or something like that as much as he could have. But he's, you know, so far he hasn't taken a ton of shots, you know, but he has, you know, exploited, you know, the Bucks defense when he has gotten open looks. He's taken them. He's shooting 50% for the series. Just overall being a really solid guy, somebody who, you know, Bud was saying on Tuesday night, is just a real luxury for him to have off the bench because he trusts him so much with being the point guard, playing off the ball, defending, you know, basically one through three. There were times where he got switched on to, you know, one of the Celtics bigs, and he handles himself well in those situations too. He knows to do his work early to try and deny the pass, just kind of really bend his knees and bow up and try and, you know, be strong there in the post. It's just a long way of saying there's not many things that George Hill can't do, and that's really been a boon for the Bucks.
We've talked about Chris Middleton's contract situation before, but I just want to reframe it one more time. After yet another great playoff performance, he hit all three of his three-point shots in Game 1, finished with a double-double. Game 2, he's even better. 7 of 10 from three-point range, 10 of 18 overall, 28 points. He was playoff Chris Middleton, like we saw last year against the Celtics, just the best player on the floor for the Bucks last year at times, most of the time, and again, delivering here. I think it's as simple as if the Bucks want to pay him the max money that the Bucks can pay him, he will be a Buck again because they can pay him more than other teams. Certainly there are going to be other teams that want his services and will pay a max contract for them. Is it as simple as saying if the Bucks want him, he will be a Buck next year?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Well, as long as he wants it, he has to want all of that too. You know, yes, they can offer him the max, and the max that they can offer is more than any other team can offer. But he doesn't have to take it. Like, he can say, hey, like, that's great. I love money, but I'm going to go take someone else's money because I don't want to be here. Now, there are no indications at all that is something that can or will happen. He has said to me, he has said to other people multiple times that he loves being in Milwaukee. His career has really flourished in Milwaukee since he got here in 2013 as part of the what was nominally the Brandon Jennings, Brandon Knight trade, which has since become the, oh my God, the Bucks got Chris Middleton for that trade. So that's, you know, that's not something that I think anybody is worried about the Bucks. You know, general manager John Horst has said multiple times that, you know, Chris is a priority for them. They want to keep him. And it's easy to see why when he is 10 of 14 from threes in a playoff series. And going back to last year, is now 35 of 55 against the Celtics when it comes to three pointers. I mean, that's 63.6%. That's pretty good from what I've heard. So I know that last year Boston fans were talking about the nightmares that Chris Middleton gave them, and he's right back to being the boogeyman. He's been fantastic throughout this series. A little understated in game one. He was 5 of 12, 3 of 4 on threes. You know, in a game where no one had it going, Chris was pretty good. But then suddenly, you know, he just went all Human Torch in game two. You know, I likened him to Totino's pizza rolls, fresh out of the oven or the microwave. Delicious. I mean, just fiery hot, like lava.
Like your tongue doesn't recover for 2-3 days.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, that's what he was doing. I mean, he was you know, very confidently stepping in to pull up threes in transition in the half court. He got open for more corner threes than I'm used to. You know, obviously, he's a good three-point shooter, a good corner three-point shooter. But the Bucks really haven't activated him in that space very often this season. And getting him to the corner and getting those wide-open looks, I mean, if you're the Bucks, you can't ask for much more. That, you know, when you have an all-star, a three-point shooter of his caliber, just wide open in the corner on multiple occasions, that's just good offense. And so, you know, he... I don't think there's enough good things you could say about the way that he played in game two. I don't think he can keep this up. I mean, he did last year against the Celtics, but like, man, like, it's just so hard to imagine that he's going to, you know, keep up 10 of 14 on threes for the duration of a playoff series. But even if he cools off, I mean, he's just at such a high heat right now. Even if he cools off, he could probably still be really good, you know, just with a you know, kind of a normal night. I mean, that's what the Bucks need from him. They need him, you know, to put up, you know, average or above average nights, you know, relative to what he's capable of. And if he can do that, you know, particularly, you know, reach that above average point in multiple games for the rest of the series, that's going to put them, you know, in great position to advance.
Yeah, if that vocal subset of Bucks fans are still down on Chris Middleton after his Game 2 performance, there's just nothing that's ever going to satisfy them, because he was money in a big spot in Game 2 on Tuesday night. Quick flashback to a couple questions ago where I called George Hill diminutive. I recognize that he's 6'3 and like a full half a foot taller than me, so I just don't want to give the wrong impression that that's actually a real adjective to describe George Hill, just relatively speaking, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and going back to Chris Middleton and all the people, you know, there's so many questions this season. Like, is he a real number two? Is he a good enough number two? Like, should he get a max? What is he even worth? Like, all that kind of stuff. And, like, people always ask me, you know, how I felt about that. I was like, well, let's see what happens in the playoffs. Like, what is he worth? Let's see what happens in the playoffs. Like, let's see how far the Bucks go. Because if, you know, if he didn't show up in the playoffs, then that would change my answer. But based on what he's done so far, I think that also changes my answer. And I was someone who, you know, just because of the way the contracts work and the salary cap and all that, I have always expected that the Bucks would give Chris Middleton the max or near the max. I believe I'm on record in probably multiple platforms saying that. Just because if they don't pay him, they really can't pay anyone else. Like, they don't just magically get that money back. They have his bird rights. They can go over the cap to sign him. And so, and if they didn't offer him that kind of money, it would be a sign of disrespect, because someone else would offer him as much as they can, because he's that good of a player. He is an all-star. Whether you want to say he was worthy of being an all-star or not is totally up for debate and, you know, worth questioning at some level. But yeah, I even wouldn't say that he's one of the top 24 players in the league, but he is clearly valuable. The market for free agents is really what determines who gets a max and who doesn't. Like, when are you a free agent? How many other people are free agents at the same time that are worthy of a max? And, you know, are you able to command that money? And this summer, he will command that money, because some team will have that money and they will not get, you know, one of the premier guys, you know, potentially like Kevin Durant, you know, Kawhi Leonard, Kyrie Irving. Like, not all those guys are going to sign. Every team can't sign a guy like that. So at some point, teams have money left over and they're like, hey, who's left? Oh, like Tobias Harris and Chris Middleton and, you know, maybe a few other guys. And then that's how somebody gets a max. Because teams have money, they need to spend it, they need to make a splash, and they need to do something with the guys who are available. And so, you know, all the debate has been raging around Chris Middleton all year long, but he's, you know, put up a really quality season, and he is absolutely showing up when the Bucks need him the most, at least so far in the playoffs.
Yeah, one of the sort of choruses, you've heard it all year, but I definitely noticed this from, I know we get into the weeds if we're talking about what the national guys are saying, but one of the things I heard the national guys saying after game one was the Bucks don't have anybody after Giannis, that they don't have a clear number two, they don't have other guys who can step up. And I just think that's so tired. We've seen it over and over from Chris Middleton this year and Eric Bledsoe, who granted was nowhere near his best in game one, really struggled, obviously bounced back, had a really nice game two. But like you said, they're not maybe the top 24 players in the league, and maybe that threshold is enough to disqualify Chris Middleton in the eyes of many from being seen as somebody who can contribute at that level. But they've got so many guys who are really good, if not superstars, really good. And that has been why this team won 60 games in the regular season. And Chris Middleton is an all-star. He's a legitimate all-star. He's not a guy who made a roster because there was an opening. He's a guy who's legitimately an all-star player. When you heard what national guys were saying after the game, again, we'll get in the weeds just real briefly here. I've only got a couple more questions for you. Did they have a point? There were people who said the series was over. One of them was Paul Pierce, who like has a little bit of a vested interest there, but there. The way that the Bucks were handled in Game 1 was so stark, and so we just have not seen them dominated like that hardly at all this season, and a team that seemingly kind of figured them out a little bit. That's sort of what the impression we were left with after Game 1, when you knew that they would bounce back a little bit. But did you feel like, you know, maybe that's really how this series is going to go? Maybe the Bucks are going to, you know, struggle to extend this series to 6-7 games? Or did you just feel like Game 1 was a complete and total aberration?
I thought Game 1 was mostly an aberration in the sense that the Bucks weren't going to play that bad the rest of the series, and the Celtics weren't going to play that good. I think that the Celtics put together a great game plan, well executed, you know, shot really well, including on some tough shots and plenty of open shots. But they were great. Like, I don't want to make any, you know, bones about it. Like, they were great. And the Bucks were terrible. Like, that was as bad as I've seen the Bucks, really at any point this season. You can only pick out a couple other games. Obviously that Orlando game in which Giannis didn't play that they lost by 20. There was the Miami game where they scored 8 points in the first quarter, and just were anemic offensively, you know, and still had a chance to win. There was the first game in Indiana where, Giannis couldn't get much of anything going. Middleton was frustrated by the shots that he was and wasn't getting. And they really couldn't do much. And then, of course, there were the two games against Phoenix, which you're like, what? Like, I don't really know what they're doing. So, you know, all those games, but none of those games was as bad, I think, as game one against the Celtics, just because of the timing, the circumstance, the way they got blown out, how thoroughly they got dominated. And so, like, when you look at it that way, it's like, okay, well, the Bucks got totally crushed in game one. They lost by 22. They played terribly. The Celtics played great. Like, how often does that happen again? Like, how often does that happen in a 7-game series? And the answer really is not often. Like, and I think you say the same thing for game two. Like, how often are the Bucks going to shoot, you know, in the 40s in terms of their 3-point percentage? They shot 42.6%, making 20 of 47 threes. How many times are they going to make that many? Like, how many times, you know, are they going to, you know, go through a stretch in the third quarter where, you know, they're getting stop after stop after stop? Like, the Celtics had 18 possessions and made a basket on one of them in the final 7 minutes of the third quarter. Like, that's just not going to happen very often. The Celtics are too good for that. They're shot makers. Whether the shots are tough or not, like, they're good enough to do much better than that over the course of the series, especially as it goes back to Boston. And so, yeah, I think they've traded haymakers each team in the first two games, and I'm expecting that it's going to get closer as the series goes on. You know, the Celtics, they showed their strategy. They made their adjustment right away. The Bucks answered right back with adjustments of their own, and I'm sure that, you know, there'll be tinkering, there'll be adjustments as the series goes on. But I think it's going to go from these two extremes and start working its way tighter and tighter, and should be a really fun series to watch.
Last thought, one of the sort of subplots on social media was the enthusiasm of the crowd. Certainly they were taken out of game one because the Bucks were struggling pretty much throughout, except for one stretch in the second quarter. And then even in game two, the Bucks got down, I think, 12-5 early. There was some rumblings that the fans just weren't into it. They're maybe not as into it on both ends of the floor. You've mentioned before how the Bradley Center was just a louder venue, probably just a smaller, tighter venue. Maybe it's because of the way the concourses are built, or it's just I don't know. There's also this pervasive nervousness that the Bucks fan base is experiencing because they have not been out of the first round in 18 years. So there's probably a little of that as well. I'm sure every fan base to a degree has a little, I don't know what you'd call it, despair when it comes to their own sports teams. But there was, I'm sure, a bigger swagger when Detroit was in town because the Bucks were so heavily favored and it was pretty clear what was going to happen in that series. What is your impression of the crowd so far? Do you feel like they're not holding their own? Because obviously in the latter stages of game two, they picked it up. How would you evaluate it?
They were definitely ready for game two. I mean, they had a lot of reasons to cheer, and they were loud. Even when the Bucks, got off to a little bit of a slow start, people were loud. They're trying to kind of get them into the game and give them that noise, that encouragement to kind of feed off of. And as Chris Middleton, made shot after shot, you could sense the anticipation anytime that he went up. People expected every shot to go in, and when they did, the crowd erupted. When they didn't, it was kind of just a sense of bewilderment, from the crowd. But I think the crowd is really good. I mean, I know the folks in Milwaukee have gotten some flack throughout the season, from different telecasts and just, in general about, it being quiet at times. But there were also situations where the Bucks were winning by, large sums. And when that happens, it's kind of just like, okay, well, this is fun. Like, they're going to win. Like, there's no drama. And so the more drama that there is, the more the crowd is going to be into it. And in the dramatic moments of game two, as few as there ended up being toward the end, like in that third quarter, the crowd was in a frenzy. That they, when there's a 39-18 quarter with a 24-2 run, they did not disappoint in terms of their reactions. Giannis made a point to thank the crowd and mention the crowd after the game, talking about the way that they fed off them and they felt that support. And so now the Bucks are going to go to a really tough, hostile environment at TD Garden where, that crowd is always up. They are in their seats, ready right when the game starts. They are bringing it. They are going to be, getting on Eric Bledsoe. They're going to be calling him Drew Bledsoe. They're going to be chanting about who was he. But it's not just going to be him. Like, anytime Giannis does anything, they're going to be all over him. If he airballs a three, which it happens, they're going to be all over him then. When he's at the free throw line, taking his eight dribbles and slow approach, they're going to be loud the whole time. And last year in the playoffs, the Bucks didn't beat the Celtics. They at TD Garden. They were 0-4 at TD Garden. That's why they lost. If you can't win on the road in the playoffs, you're going to be in trouble if you don't have home court advantage. That's just, simply how it is. The Bucks lost their first game of the season. Their first loss of the season came at TD Garden. And then later on, they were able to get one back and finally kind of exercise the demons there a little bit. But the playoffs are going to be a whole other animal. And so, being able to get out to a better start, the Bucks have not been very good at getting off good starts against Celtics in this series or this season really in general. But getting off to a good start, trying to take the crowd out of it as much as you can, that'll be a key. And being able to prove their mettle, they've been a great away team all year, but being able to prove their mettle in the playoffs, especially in game three, and to set that tone and to try and take a 2-1 series lead, I think that'll all be very critical.
Two guarantees. When a team isn't playing well, commentators and analysts get blamed for not being impartial, and the crowd gets blamed for not being partial enough. Third guarantee I'll give you is that Matt Velasquez is your best source for Milwaukee Bucks content. You can read everything he has to say at jsonline.com. You can see his post-game video with Olivia Reiner last night, his wrap-up of the game. He's obviously going to have more to say here in the next few days. Bucks will be playing at TD Garden. They have to win there now. They must win one of the three potential remaining games at TD Garden if they want to win this series in Boston. That starts on Friday. They'll play again 2 days later. Matt, thanks for joining us. Safe travels out east, and we will chat with you again very soon.
All right. Can't wait.
Thank you to Matt for joining us. You can find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating and review, please. Also, you can find me, I'm J.R. Radcliffe, on Twitter at J.R.R.A.D.C.L.I.F.F.E. Hopefully you enjoy what's to come. The Bucks game again on Friday. I misspoke. Their second game in Boston will be on Monday, not 2 days later, but 3 days later. And then, of course, they'll come back to Milwaukee the following Wednesday for Game 5. That game is guaranteed to happen at this point with the series tied at 1-1. Also, a quick shout-out, if you want to catch me Friday, I'll be on the ESPN Radio Sidecast with Pratik Patel and his rotating wheel of guests talking about the Bucks during the game. It's sort of a second screen opportunity. You watch the game at home and, have us on in the background as we're talking, making conversation, some analysis, some just good-natured humor, et cetera, et cetera. Just a bunch of guys sitting around talking Bucks ball. So find us on Friday. You can follow ESPN Milwaukee on Twitter, Facebook. That's where you'll find the live stream of the Sidecast. And you can maybe see me in the flesh. Matt Velasquez, once again, find everything he writes at jsonline.com. I've got plenty of stuff up there as well. Some Twitter reactions from the game Tuesday night. Green Bay Packers were in attendance. Adrian Amos got a flat tire on his way to the game. Also wrote about an NHL player who's got an interesting tie to Milwaukee who was sporting some Bucks gear. He's Brandon Dubinsky of the Columbus Blue Jackets. They are playing the Boston Bruins in the NHL playoffs right now. Actually, they'll be at TD Garden the day after the Bucks. It'll be Friday, Saturday, basketball, hockey doubleheader there. So he's rooting for the Bucks. Maybe he's also just plain old rooting against Boston. Not entirely clear, but kind of a fun story again. Find that at jsonline.com. Also, check out our Brewers podcast. We're coming at you every week. The Brewers have won a couple games to open up the week here against the New York Mets. My conversations with Todd Rosiak and Tom Hodricourt, also available at Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, or just jsonline.com. Thanks for listening. We will catch you again next week. Take care.